The headlines this hour. The number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. tops 24 million as the world's worst-hit country approaches 400,000 COVID deaths. The Iranian Army's ground force holds military exercises in the south of the country. Also in the headlines, the U.N. Secretary General urges Israel to halt and to reverse its recent decision to build 800 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Total deaths from coronavirus in the U.S. are approaching 400,000. That's according to the latest data by the country's Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. death toll is higher than that of any country in the world. The U.S. also has the largest infection tally, with more than 24 million cases. Currently, California is the hardest hit U.S. state by the pandemic. On Monday, it became the first American state to record more than 3 million COVID infections. Meanwhile, multiple states have reported cases of the new COVID variant first detected in the U.K., and that has raised concerns, even though daily infections have been trending down in the U.S. over the past week. Over in France, the average daily coronavirus infections have hit over a six-week high, with more than 18,000 confirmed cases. Unlike Britain or Germany, the French government has stopped short of imposing a third national lockdown. However, a nationwide curfew remains in place to curb the surge in cases. France has so far reported over 70,000 deaths out of more than 2.9 million cases. Meanwhile, the UK has closed its travel corridors until February 15th to curb the spread of a new COVID variant as Europe keeps struggling with a second wave of the pandemic. Meanwhile, in Germany, the health minister says while the infection numbers seem to be decreasing, the country is still not stable.
We see both in the infection numbers, which seem to be going down where we look at the last few days, as well as the situation in the intensive care units, where there are 10 to 15% fewer COVID-19 patients now than at the peak. That seems to be moving in the right direction, but we are still a long way from where we need to be.
German authorities have registered over 7,000 new cases, taking the total infections to over 2 million. The virus has also so far claimed more than 47,000 lives in the country. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy registered nearly 9,000 new cases and 377 more deaths. The country has logged over 82,000 deaths so far, the second highest in Europe. Portugal's daily death toll from the virus also reached a record high of 167 on Monday, bringing the total to over 9,000. The country has been under lockdown since last week, with hospitals struggling to cope with soaring contagion. The World Health Organization says the world faces a catastrophic moral failure because of unequal COVID vaccine policies.
I need to be blunt. The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure. And the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries.
The WHO chief said that over 39 million doses of vaccines have been distributed in at least 49 higher-income nations. That is while he said one poor country had only received 25 doses. He called on all countries to work together to ensure that medical workers and the elderly get vaccinated in the first 100 days of this year. Vaccination has started in some countries with already authorized COVID vaccines. The Iranian army has once again staged a military exercise in the country's south. This time, the ground forces of the army showed off their capabilities amid heightened tensions with the U.S. over its presence in the region. Our correspondent Human Abadi has attended the drills.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war games is to evaluate the mobility and defense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile defense units of the Army Ground Forces. We also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's army commander, Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks.
The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi, Josk.
Earlier we were joined by the spokesman for the ongoing Iranian military drills. Qumas Sharafi gave us more details about the exercises.
Drills featured an operation, a joint airborne operation by Brigade 55 of the Airborne Division of the Land Force using transport planes from the farthest point in the country. And these operations featured parachuters of Airborne Division's land, and they conducted a joint airborne operation successfully. The operation was conducted successfully. One of the features of these maneuvers is the transportation operations, airborne transportation. Rapid reaction forces and special forces also took part, and given the actually threats that the country is facing. And we, in these drills, we managed to conduct operations in an area which has been designated for the drills, and we conducted land operations as well.
Qatar has called on Persian Gulf Arab countries to hold talks with Iran to solve disputes. Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said that he is hopeful that such talks will happen. He said that Qatar will facilitate the negotiations if asked by stakeholders. Last month, GCC members Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE reestablished diplomatic ties with Qatar after breaking them off in June 2017. The trio broke the ties at that time partly because of Qatar's relations with Iran. Tehran has repeatedly said it's open to any initiative that helps ease tensions in the Persian Gulf region. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello and welcome to the news review. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged Israel to halt and to reverse its recent plan to build new sector units in the occupied West Bank. Guterres said Israel's settlement construction in the Palestinian territory, occupied since 1967, has no legal validity. He said that such activities are a flagrant violation under international law. According to the UN chief, Israel's expansionism further erodes the possibility of ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state. Israel approved the construction of 780 new settler units on Sunday, following an order by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. An Israeli settlement watchdog has said most of the units will be built deep in the West Bank. All Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law. Edward Corrigan is an international human rights lawyer joining us from London, Ontario. We also have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign joining us from Edinburgh. Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Edward Corrigan. Antonio Guterres is a UN Secretary General. Israel is one of the entities that has violated UN sanctions the most out of any member countries of the UN. How could the UN Secretary General statement in this case make any difference on Israeli plans, in this case for building more illegal settlements?
Well, in my opinion, it'll make no impact at all. The UN has been arguing since 1967 that Israel's settlements and any expansion of Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank and in Gaza are all illegal, and any confiscation is not recognized under international law. But these are just words. What Netanyahu has his eyes focused on is the election that's coming up in a couple months in Israel, and everybody is competing for the votes of the Jewish settlers and the right wing in Israel. So the entire political spectrum in Israel has shifted to the right. So you could argue that the Likud party, headed by Netanyahu, is actually the most moderate party in the Israeli Knesset. There are very few supporters of peace, and the Arab list is actually like the second biggest party in the Knesset, but it has no say in the governance. But what is going on is that the settlers who go there, they're going to get free land, they're going to get heavily subsidized, they're going to get support from the Israeli government. And of course, this is all subsidized by the United States, by Britain, France, Germany, and other Western European countries. So they're competing for votes, and they know that the words and the resolutions will have no impact. I think Israel is in violation of over 60 UN resolutions. And, but nobody's done anything. Until you hit them in the pocketbook, until you kick them out of the UN, until you do something really concrete and, forbid their trade. But it's the reverse. The Israelis keep trading backs, and they keep, slow motion annexation of the West Bank and really slow motion genocide of the Palestinians.
Well, if we were to take a look, Mick Napier, as to the chances that the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden may have on Israel to stop some of this illegal activities, would that be wishful thinking, or do you think that there will make that this incoming administration may make a difference? I mean, let's not forget, Israel was no fan of the former U.S. President Barack Obama. Neither was Obama a fan of Israel, so to speak. And in this case, Biden was part of that administration. How do you think Biden will be dealing with Israel?
It's very difficult to say that it will make no difference between a creature like Trump and a more rational character such as Joe Biden. But we must remember that while Netanyahu was furiously angry against Obama and supported Trump against Obama, Obama's parting gift to the Israelis on the final days of his presidency was $38 billion extra dollars of military and other aid. So even though the love wasn't returned, the Obama administration and Biden were really very, very militant supporters of Israel during massacres, during crimes, during dispossession, and so on. Look, I think the basic question you've asked is about Guterres, and I think Guterres is afraid because he's posing the issue as only one of 780 settlements. But the issue is not that. The issue is that right across the whole of historic Palestine, everywhere that Israel controls, whether direct military control in the West Bank or periodic inflictions of terror on Gaza or bureaucratically in large parts of Palestine, the same process of dispossession is underway, where there is an ongoing orgy of destruction of Palestinian homes and construction of Jewish-only settlements. It's not just in the West Bank. The same process takes place everywhere. And Guterres has a record here. He is terrified that the growing international consensus is even reaching into Israel. A major Israeli human rights group, fairly timid group, has just said that Israel's an apartheid state from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River. Now, apartheid is a crime against humanity. And this emerging consensus pulls the rug from under Guterres because he's desperate to maintain that the issue is occupation. Israel is otherwise a fairly healthy entity, and if only they would end expanding the settlements, there could be there could be a solution. But that's not the problem. The problem is it's an apartheid state dedicated to the dispossession and expulsion of as many Palestinians as possible, and the focus on the settlements is welcome, but it forgets the fact that the Palestinians are subject to virtual shoot to kill by soldiers in the West Bank, the most imprisoned people on earth, and the expansion of the settlements is very much in the Zionist DNA. They are expansionist or they are nothing, and Guterres won't face up to that. Indeed, when the UN commissioned a report in 2017 which reached this same conclusion, authored by Richard Falk, Guterres moved very quickly to suppress that report, to suppress a UN report which said the problem isn't just the settlements, that's a major problem, but the problem is so much bigger. It's the Zionist project of colonization and dispossession.
Thank you. Edward Corey on there, international human rights lawyer in Ontario. Thank you for your thoughts. And also, Mick Napier, thank you, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And that is for the news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Human Rights Watch has called on Israel to provide Palestinians with the coronavirus vaccines. In a statement, the international body said that the Israeli regime must ensure the vaccines are equally provided to the Palestinians in order to meet its obligations under international law. Ashraf Shannon has more.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel, as an occupying power, to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Under the 4th Geneva Convention, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochran, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
He loves the game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist.
Controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win-at-all-cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
He got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest
lie, loser.
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed. I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all of the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He just doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news. But I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe, you know, maybe he'd be a good one.
So it just gave
me the chills. It's
and horrifying. What about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but
absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but has been involved in countless campaigns. But also, we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting. Yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So
years in the making. Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse. I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure, and you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This is what was so useful about this film, was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say, this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment. And that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon. And we see this through the film. When they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized, and it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment has been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone that he's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows. Roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. It's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with and Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up because we're about to go to him just now. So we'll just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, when he denies being fired, the fact Manafort recommends suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place,
they say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and it's not, they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
He knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But surely would discredit
part of this,
Trump.
He's part of this, and it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
that is a very interesting point. And yeah. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stones where he said the NBC's, the CNN, actually, they're marginalised now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but are becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme centre. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's a, I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that. The work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get, because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going to win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Kamila Shambayati.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسيم المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه المسيح المصطفى حق إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the important sermons that are there in this very important and powerful book is the Sermon of the Pious People, or the Khutbatul Muttaqin, which is the sermon number 184 in this book. In this particular sermon, of course, which is counted as one of the most important, rather one of the pinnacles of, you know, both wonder and beauty in terms of linguistic, you know, matters, and also in terms of its content, it is counted one of the most powerful sermons. In this sermon, many different qualities and traits of the pious people have been mentioned, and one of them, of course, is the quality of contentment. The phrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam uses here is tarahu qani'atan nafsu, that you will see that his nafs, or his heart, or his soul is in a state of contentment. And in the previous session, of course, we have dealt with it quite in different dimensions. But in the previous session, we mentioned one of the questions that arise from the discussion of contentment, and that is that on the one hand, Islam encourages us to progress economically, to progress in different fields of technology, right, and improve our lifestyle. At the same time, we are told to be content, and how to balance these two different statements. Inshallah, we will discuss about this today.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, based on the discussion we started with before the break, we mentioned that there is this contradiction seemingly in the statements of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam regarding the issue of contentment. As I said, on the one hand, we are told to be content and happy with whatever Allah has decided. On the other hand, we are told to be, you know, to work hard and to struggle, and to try to earn and develop and improve and advance. These two statements are there. Now, how do we understand this properly? We will try to, you know, summarize a bit the discussions here. It's quite an important discussion, and unfortunately, you know, it may have not been given the right amount of attention required. And the depth required, it may have, in my little knowledge. But of course, there are books that have discussed this in quite good depth. One of the answers that is given here is that when we say that Allah wants us to be pleased with what He has divided, and therefore be content with what He has divided, it includes the abilities that God has given you. So since God has given us the ability to work hard, God has given you the ability to struggle, to be able to be independent, God has given you the ability to live a life that is good, that is advanced, That means this is one of those things that God has divided for you as a person. But sometimes some people don't have that ability. That ability does not belong, they don't have it. Here is where the contentment comes. So for example, one person has the ability to earn, let us say, 100,000, let's say, maybe coins. Another person has the ability to earn 1,000 coins. That's much how his ability is. The one who can earn 100,000 coins should not say that, okay, I'm content with 1,000 and I don't need to earn 100,000, especially if he has already divided his time properly and can actually improve himself in business. Here, it wouldn't be called contentment. Here, it would be called wasting the potentials that God has given you. It would be a form of israf. This is one of the answers that could be given.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So, as I mentioned previously, one of the answers is that when we say that Allah has divided for you your rizq, is division of the abilities that people have. One who knows that I have this much ability, that means my capacity is 1,000, so I should be content with that 1,000. And not always worry about why don't I have more than that. If that is your ability, so first a person needs to discover the abilities that he has inside him. This was one answer. Another answer is that the whole of Islamic morality, or ilmul akhlaq as we say, one of the most important bases according to some of the scholars is that ilmul akhlaq is looking for a state of balance and equilibrium within the soul, a state of peace within the soul, and the state of peace in the society, a state of peace also in the heart. That is what the ilm al-akhlaq actually is for. And if you look at the statements of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, if you look at the whole of Islam, the name Islam, first of all, which comes from peace, right? The whole idea of saying salamun alaykum as a greeting, right? All of these, all for example in heaven, when you will enter heaven, the one of the first greetings you will be given is salamun alaykum tibtum. Okay, or for example in the Quran regarding heaven, it is known as darus salam, the land of peace or the abode of peace. That means all of these different akhlaqi statements, moral statements, want us to actually achieve a state of peace. Now, assume that a person has the ability to develop economically, but does not and suppresses that ability with the excuse of contentment. That means he has ignored the equilibrium that God wants to be achieved in the society and the person, inshallah. Regarding this particular point, because of lack of time, inshallah, we will slowly develop it, the discussion in the next session, God willing. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRI.